Latham and others versus Castillo and others.
May it please the court, Deborah Thunderman, the petitioner, argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for the argument.
May it please the court. If left undisturbed, the Court of Appeals' opinion in this case gives us two anomalous results. One is that an attorney can be sued for failing to file a frivolous lawsuit. Second is that a client can recover from mental anguish damages, even acknowledging that those damages are suffered because of the loss of an asset that client concedes is valueless. That is why Latham is calling upon this court today to answer the question left open by this court, expressly left open, in the opinions of DeBakey v. Sags and Willis v. Maverick.
You're saying the client agrees that the lawsuit was frivolous?
Since the client has to concede that it had no value because they failed to prove that up.
And the well, that's a failure of proof. It's not establishing it as frivolous as a matter of law, is it?
Well, no, it's not establishing it frivolous as a matter of law, but the only evidence in this record is that there was no medical malpractice for them to file a lawsuit on. And so I believe that for purposes of our argument here, we have to concede that there is no value. And so the question is, what theory of liability is going to apply to an attorney who does not do his job? And the answer, we believe, is conclusively and exclusively a legal malpractice founding in negligence and tort. And there are three main categories that compel this conclusion. One is our general jurisprudence.
I'm sorry, counsel. You said there's no DTPA cause of action against a lawyer?
For this type of cause of action, no.
Would there be for any?
There could be, yes. Just the fact that you are a lawyer does not exempt you from the DTPA. But it's our position that you have to look to the substance of the cause of action, the gravamen of the complaint, and see if there is any professional judgment or opinions being exercised. And
if there are, then you can't be sued under the DTPA?
No, I think your remedy is under negligence.
So yes. You can't sue under the DTPA?
Right. I think this is along the lines of the Crawford versus Ace Sign case, where you said, if you've got a contract cause of action, it's a contract cause of action. You can't dress it up in DTPA clothing. And that's what's happening here. Factually, which is the second point, and I'll get back to the first one, but if you look at the allegations and the testimony in this case, factually, what you have is a garden variety negligence case. You have allegations that a lawyer took the case and didn't file it. This is not a situation where there are allegations that the defendant, in addition to a defalcation of a duty, beat or raped or swindled a client.
Let me ask you this. Is it correct that the record does say that Castillo's heard from your client that, quote, I'll file both cases? And then, secondly, that I have filed both cases?
That's what they testified to.
So that's in the record?
Right. I think if you look at the actual language, it's a little bit equivocal. But I don't know that I can really argue or dispute that.
So why isn't that some evidence that Mr. Latham promised to do something that he did not, in fact, do?
We're not arguing here that there is no evidence that he took on the case. Because of our directed verdict procedural posture, have not put on the rest of the evidence, but we have to concede that there is a scintilla of evidence that, according to them, they believe that he had taken on the case.
Can you recover mental anguish damages for an intentional in violation of the DTPA?
I believe that the cases that have held that you do recover mental anguish damages because of the representation all involve situations where the representation was made in an effort to gain an economic advantage. Like, this asset has more value than it really does. Something of that nature when you're trying to sell it. Here, none of the representations he made were designed in any way, if we accept them as true, as gaining an economic advantage.
There's a certain, difficulty in the rule you're arguing for when it comes to a lawyer who is said he would file a lawsuit and then, and did file a lawsuit and then has not filed a lawsuit, who later on says, well, it's a frivolous lawsuit when he gets sued for malpractice. Is that just the way it works?
Well, I think it sounds squirrely, for lack of a better word, when we are in this directed verdict posture and we have not been able to put on our defense, because he did have a defense that he never agreed to take on this case.
I understand your procedural posture limits things.
But the point that I think the fundamental analysis here is that we have these different theories, different causes of action, because we have to evaluate conduct under a standard appropriate to that conduct. And so if there is a chance that an attorney is going to have to exercise professional judgment, in this case, on whether or not the case has enough merit to file, we have to look at a standard that allows that to be evaluated. And to say that it falls under the DTPA rather than under a negligence standard effectively makes that whole consideration irrelevant. And so we have a situation where if indeed it was frivolous, and we believe it was, and the only evidence is that it was, if it's a DTPA cause of action, we don't have any way to show that because it's not relevant. If they object to it or if they do a motion in limine about any evidence having to do with the merit of that cause of action, because we no longer have to approve a suit within a suit, we're stuck. We have no defense. And so keeping it a negligence cause of action assures that that defense is there.
Well, are you arguing then that there should be no connection with the DTPA with legal malpractice whatsoever?
I think if it is garden variety legal malpractice dealing with something that has to do with a lawyer's judgment, yes. I think if the lawyer goes beyond that.
Well, it already says that in the book, and didn't it say that at the time these claims arose?
No, this happened before those amendments. So this lawsuit is predicated on the ability to recover actual damages for an unconscionable action, unconscionable being defined as taking undue advantage or unfair consideration.
Well, do you see a difference between the fact that a DTPA is a statutory claim that exists in addition to whatever common law remedies might be available to a litigant?
Well, I think it has the same sort of status as a contract action versus DTPA. And if you already have a common law remedy, that
But don't you answer that with that the DTPA is in addition to, but not in lieu of, common law remedies?
Well, it does, there are situations where it is in addition to.
Well, it doesn't limit it, does it? The way the statute reads.
I don't think it limits it on its face. But I think that the jurisprudence of the state has to recognize that certain types of conduct can't be evaluated under the DTPA, because to do so is to shift burden and to make it as if a lawyer's conduct, he's got strict liability. That if he messes up in any way, we're no longer looking at whether or not he had an appropriate exercise of judgment. We're looking at whether or not the job got done. And if it didn't get done, then
So your viewpoint is it doesn't make any difference that if, and we have to look at what they said as being true because of the directed verdict situation, that they said, he said, I will file them, and then said, I have filed them, and neither of those facts are true. That's not something different than what you're arguing about his judgment on whether the case is good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, I think if you take out the question of the exercise of judgment, then we abandon what has historically been the requirement of these types of causes of action, which is the suit.
Well, doesn't what he said, if true, have nothing to do with the merits of the case or common law claim for legal malpractice, but a claim for fraud, which is what they're claiming?
Well, I think that there can be, if their testimony rises to the level of showing a fraud, which it does not, because there was no evidence of a present intention not to do things or of the reliance on damages.
Well, let's zero in on I have filed it when he had it.
Okay.
That's not true, is it?
No, that would not be true. And the question is, what did they lose? And if we're looking at the DTPA as the remedy, then we have to say, okay, if there's been this deceptive trade practice, and he said that he filed something and he lost it because he didn't, then you need to find the economic damages that they lost. Because otherwise, you are insuring every representation, anytime anyone might say something that's not true, then you're going to have a DTPA claim for the mental anguish that might result.
Isn't the client entitled at least to perhaps a second opinion if Mr. Latham decided not to file the case because he didn't think it was meritorious, didn't he deprive the Castillos of the opportunity to go to another lawyer who might have, let's say, been more creative or perhaps investigated and found some non-frivolous basis to pursue?
Under the record in this case, I don't think that we can evaluate it that way, because if you're going to say that they were deprived of this right to get another opinion, then shouldn't they at least bring in some testimony under their burden of proof to say someone else would have looked at it and would have taken it?
Well, the rule you're arguing for, I think, would apply. You're saying this would apply in every case, not just under the facts in this case, aren't you? Are you saying you would never have a DTPA cause of action unless you can prove that you would have recovered and collected a judgment in the underlying lawsuit?
Well, I think you have to.
So it's not just, the rule you're asking us to adopt is not just limited to the facts of this case.
Well, I think that the facts of this case make it very easy to adopt the rule that we're arguing, because it is such a garden variety negligence case. And I'm not prepared to rule out the possibility that there may be some time when a representation might result in an economic detriment that would bring the case under the DTPA.
There was no fee paid here?
No fee, no record of any fee.
So it was taken on a condition. There were two causes of action, is that correct?
Right. There was, he took the legal malpractice case against their prior lawyer and got them a $400,000 settlement. And then the Castillo claims that he also took this medical malpractice case that did not get filed. And as far as what is in the record, there is no contract in the record to show that he ever got a fee or that it was even contingency. I presume it was.
Did they testify that they signed four blank employment contracts?
That was their testimony. That they had four pieces of paper that had blanks in them that they signed.
How did they recover a $400,000 settlement from the lawyer for failing to sue the doctors if there wasn't any suit against the doctors? That was frivolous.
There were two children, and the lawsuit for the first child was filed and resulted in a default for $6 million. The hospital apparently lost the papers or whatever.
And that was settled for
$70,000? Right. On the representation of the hospital medical providers that they would file bankruptcy before they pay the judgment. And then the Castillos felt that settlement was too low, and so we have the legal malpractice case against that lawyer that nets them the close to $400,000. I say nets them, I don't know what he got out of it.
Let me ask a question, Ms. Sinnerman. You're arguing that this professional judgment is really what's at issue here, but even under the DTPA, does there not have to be damages produced by the conduct, I have filed in one of the elements, even under the DTPA, to prove that there were damages?
Yes, I believe so.
So if there's a knowing violation, I suppose you have mental anguish, but without a knowing violation, wouldn't there have to be some evidence that had the case been filed, there would have been a different result than there was without being filed?
Yes, we've argued in our brief that no matter what cause of action is applied to this conduct, that there's a cause and fact requirement of proving up damages. And under that cause and fact, you have to show that but for this conduct, there would have been a different outcome. So then I have about four reasons compelling against the application of the DTPA in this case. They may have been covered to some extent by the question. If this case is a DTPA case, every case can be a DTPA case, because all you have to do is say, someone told me something that wasn't true and it upset me. And if you can qualify under Parkway versus Woodruff with respect to your mental anguish damages, then suddenly you've got a DTPA claim. And it may have nothing to do with trade practices. It may not have nothing to do with commerce.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Arminda Castillo will be an argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. The Castillos offered legal and factual evidence to the jury in this cause that Mr. Latham had engaged in deceptive trade practices. The uniqueness of this case is that Mr. Latham not only lied at a deposition that he had never been hired to do anything for Kay Castillo, call number two, but he also lied at trial that he had never been hired to represent Kay by the Castillo. Before the jury is when trial counsel for the Castillos, Mr. Ganot, introduced the evidence against Mr. Latham that he, in fact, had sued Attorney One for Kay Castillo. If he didn't have authority from the Castillos and hadn't been hired by the Castillos to sue Attorney One for Kay Castillo, he was knowingly misrepresenting those facts at all times. To the Castillos before any litigation, to at deposition, and even to the jury. It went that far. Nothing stopped him. Counsel's contention that he exercised his judgment in not doing anything for Kay Castillo and the malpractice issue for which he was hired, I believe, misses the point. If he's been denying all along that he was never hired to do it, then how can he now claim that I exercised professional judgment and thought it was a frivolous lawsuit? Again, all along he has denied they didn't hire me for Kay Castillo. And the argument can be made that perhaps that's why he took the malpractice action against Attorney One, to induce the Castillos to come in with this malpractice action that he didn't intend to do anything with.
Ms. Castillo, what separates this case from a negligence cause of action, legal malpractice? What is different? Why is this not just a legal negligence malpractice action?
Sir, I wish I could answer that. I wish I could have the opportunity to talk to John Ganot. He has had a stroke. I do not know, sir, what his strategy was in abandoning the legal malpractice claim. I understand that on appeal to the 13th Court of Appeals, he admitted that he had not met that burden, but I do not know why at trial he undertook just to proceed on the DTPA action instead of the legal malpractice action. I do not know that.
Ms. Castillo, when you employ an attorney to represent you on the case, you essentially have a contract, and the attorney, implicit with the contract, says, I will take whatever steps necessary to prosecute your case. It seems to me all the evidence shows here is that Mr. Rodriguez, I guess it was, agreed to take on the case. Whether you've got a statement that says, I filed your lawsuit, or a statement that says, I will file your lawsuit, or a statement that says, I'll represent you, or I'll prosecute you, all of those are consistent with the duty taken on contractually.
Yes.
To represent the party. What is different about what gets said that would make DTPA apply to this context that would not apply in virtually any contractual arrangement among any parties, where if I agree to do something for you and I don't do it, that makes it ETPA because that's a misrepresentation. What? ETPA applies to all contracts, but what is unique about what was said here that seems mm-hmm. to say there's some sort of misrepresentation independent of just what would ordinarily be implied by my
yes.
agreement to do work for you?
The testimony of Dulce Castillo's at trial was that had Mr. Latham advised them that he wouldn't do the medical malpractice, they would have kept looking. Counsel for Mr. Latham during the trial asked about four different attorneys that had rejected the medical malpractice claim and in fact introduced into evidence a letter from a law firm indicating there's a medical, we will not take on the medical malpractice claim, we can't.
Would that be the case in any, if I try to prove damages for breach of contract in any case, wouldn't my argument be, had they not agreed to take on this case, had they not agreed to the contract, I would have gone to someplace else for that contract. I mean, isn't that just your normal damages issue?
I think it goes to bargaining power and unconscionable conduct. In this particular situation, we refer to the DTPA definition of unconscionable conduct. There was a difference in Mr. Latham's expertise being a lawyer, knowing what the law is, knowing what the rules apply to attorneys and all, and not telling the Castillos exactly what was entailed in any contract. Yeah, there's an uneven bargaining power there. And the DTPA intends to, I think, codify that. And it isn't an issue that's applicable, I think, to the public in general. You can't deceive a client. You can't misrepresent a client. You can't tell a client, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to hand you a contract, sign it, and it's blank. That alone indicates that there's a lot of room for deception. And a client that comes to you heartbroken or looking for an attorney that wants to, that will proceed with a case, will sign anything. And that's the danger, I think, that is with where attorneys are involved. And if an attorney believes that he can do that to a client, then there's a real problem there. We've got the disciplinary rules that we've got to abide by, and first and foremost, you don't produce a letter to a client for them to sign a contract to a client to sign with blanks on it. He never controverted what the Castillo said at trial, that the contract was blank. He had the opportunity to do that. He didn't.
Ms. Castillo,
yes,
excuse me. What were the allegations
of
fraudulent conduct against Mr. Latham?
That he misrepresented that...
Well, I'm looking at the pleading. There's nothing about misrepresentation alleged in the pleading that I
yes.
can find. I find fraudulent concealment. And is that's the only time the word fraudulent is mentioned?
Yes, that's the only time in the...
How do you get fraudulent misrepresentation from fraudulent concealment, allegation of concealment?
I think that, I don't think that there's a difference, Your Honor, in my opinion. If you conceal
No difference from misrepresentation from concealment?
It's an act versus an omission. It's still... The end result is fraud. You either conceal something or misrepresent it. In this case, he concealed that he had filed a lawsuit against Annette Rodriguez for Kay Castillo. He concealed that he
missed... Well, he got $400,000 from your client on that action.
No, sir. He got $400,000 for child number one who contracted meningitis at Driscoll Hospital.
But he got that not against the hospital, but against the lawyer.
Yes, sir, because Mr. Rodriguez...
Excuse me for interrupting, but it was an allegation that first lawyer committed legal malpractice.
Yes.
And the basis of the $400,000 was a legal malpractice against lawyer number one.
Yes.
Not against the hospital.
Against the lawyer, that's right.
So get back to my question. What, under your pleading, did Mr. Latham, what is he accused of concealing?
The fact that he did not, he concealed that he did not sue, that he had sued for Kay Castillo. He never told the Castillo that he had sued for Kay Castillo as well against Anel Diaz. And I know the contention is, well, he got $400,000 anyway. The Castillos were induced into signing a settlement agreement for Sarah Castillo, child number one. René Rodriguez had relinquished all claim to child number two. Latham had asked them, give me a letter from Rodriguez saying that you're turning over, that he has no claim to Kay Castillo. And so he then turns around and sues René Rodriguez for Kay Castillo. And that was a frivolous lawsuit. Talk about frivolous lawsuits.
Well, he got $400,000. How could that be a frivolous lawsuit?
No, sir. The part of the lawsuit for Kay Castillo against René Rodriguez was frivolous because that part of the lawsuit was frivolous.
You're not complaining about that. You're not going to get that $400,000 back because it was frivolous.
Sir, that's where you go to the inducement, where the Castillos were induced to believe that they settled only for Sarah.
Sorry, I don't.
Okay.
I don't follow the concealment that is metamorphosized to misrepresentation. Maybe some other.
There were two children. First one died within a week, the day she was supposed to leave from the hospital. Contracted spinal meningitis at the hospital. René Rodriguez was ultimately hired, and he brought lawsuits, default judgment, $6 million. The Castillos settled for $70,000 based upon his representation. Driscoll was going to file for bankruptcy. On the urging of Miles Latham, the Castillos retrieved their file regarding Kay, because Kay was still living while Rodriguez had been contracted by the Castillos. The reason that they contacted Rodriguez was because a doctor had sniffed Kay Castillo's brain tissue when he removed a sack at the back of her head and said, we just went ahead and sniffed it. That was a malpractice, including brain tissue, by the way. That's a malpractice that the Castillos were urging and asked Jeanette to sue. And the child was still alive. But when they found out about the incidences with René Rodriguez, then René and the actions against him, Latham said, go ahead and give me the Kay Castillo file. Then Latham turns around and sues Jeanette for not suing for Kay while Kay's still alive. And there was, that wasn't what the Castillos hired him for. They hired him to sue the hospital, not René Rodriguez, but for Kay. And
if this is a DTCA claim, then what, under your reading of the law, is the measure of damages? It is not what they lost by his failing to file the suit?
Yes, ma'am. That is a very interesting question that I gleaned Mr. Gonneau's notes, and again, because he's not able to communicate with me. He contends that there's mental anguish damages caused by the Castillos finding out that Driscoll Hospital was never sued because of Kay and the snipping of her brain tissue, making her epileptic, making her have epileptic seizures, making her blind. I left that out. She was not blind and didn't have seizures before the surgery. That's the mental languages they pursued. Mr. Latham had represented in a letter to Rodriguez without the Castillos knowing, and they find this out after, that Kay's case was worth $250,000. And Mr. Gonneau's, his notes indicate he was going to argue to the jury to cover any legal issue or concern about no quote-unquote economic damages that the act in the plan.
Well, was that introduced at trial?
This is what his argument was going to be, an inference, that the Castillos were traveling to Corpus Christi to visit. They lived in Sinton, 30 miles away. And if the jury awarded them $1 for a long-distance call or for a gallon of gasoline to travel to Corpus, if the jury awarded $1, then the issue of mental languages would just come in. And again, this is just on...
No, I'm confused. You say there is a letter that values case against the medical providers at $250,000?
Yes, Mr. Latham, in plaintiff's exhibit 4, after filing the lawsuit against Mr. Rodriguez, asked for a settlement for child one in the amount of $500,000 and for Cake Castillo for $250,000, and that was exhibit 4, plaintiff's exhibit 4 before the jury.
So that's in the record?
Yes, ma'am, that's in the record. And this was introduced after he denied having been hired to represent Kay at all.
But was there any medical testimony that the hospital was negligent in treating Kay?
No, ma'am. Well, there was lay testimony that the Castillo testified basically that they wanted a malpractice action because the doctors had cut off her brain tissue and that she became blind after that, whereas she wasn't blind before and she didn't have seizures before. So she suffered for 2 years.
On the question of law about the DTP, I'm not sure I understand what your position is. Are you conceding there has to be at least $1 of actual damages before you award mental anguish, or are you saying you can recover mental anguish damages even though there are no actual damages under other actual damages?
We're not conceding that economic damages need to be proven. We're not conceding that. And I'm just contending what Mr. Gonneau was going to argue to the jury, but for the directed verdict.
But you do agree there are no actual damages proved up in the record?
I can't agree with that because of his argument. I think that he, in asking the Castillos, did you call, did you travel to Corpus Christi, he fully intended to prove at least $1 worth of actual damage.
He didn't do that before the directed verdict was granted.
Pardon?
He didn't do that before the directed verdict was granted.
He introduced that evidence. He did.
They had phone calls and trips.
Yes, ma'am. That is part of the record. The fact that they called him, how many calls, and that was developed that he made at least three, that the Castillos made at least three trips to Mr. Latham's office from Sitting to Corpus, as well as called him and all, and the inference was, I think, that Mr. Gonneau was going to protect that issue. However, he argued to the trial court that mental anguish damages alone were sufficient under the DTPA and that no economic damages needed to be proven. I think that we don't have a definition of what actual damages is. It's now been changed, but at the time it was actual, and it's consistent with compensatory damages and any other statute, like then 5221K, the Human Rights Act, that allows compensatory damages, also the former 8307C, which allowed that type of relief also, absent any type of economic damage. And we think that at that time, the DTPA, when it said actual damages, that it can be construed consistent with case law that the mental anguish were actual damages to the Castillos.
Assuming that the lawsuit that was not filed had no value at all, settlement, verdict, anyway, assuming that it had no value, I know that's not your position, but assuming that that's true, how can you recover damages for not filing?
I think it's because of reliance on a professional, and that's Ms. Castillo's answer. We relied on the professional.
But you could have gotten, even if he had filed the lawsuit, you would have gotten nothing.
They also know that in any lawsuit, when you go in, the chances are you get zero.
No, I'm assuming, I'm asking you
yes,
to assume that this one had no value. Even if he had filed the suit, you still would have had zero. How can you get damages for not filing?
I think that's what the DTPA intended to protect, where unconscionable conduct is involved. Exactly that type of conduct, and especially because Mr. Latham is an attorney and, as a matter of fact, a personal injury specialist, just like Mr. Gonneau was, who tried the case, that the burden is on him to do everything right and not take advantage of persons with 10 years worth of education and that are looking for, that are looking to the professional for legal relief and legal recourse. It's like making a decision, are we going to go have surgery with a doctor's assistant or the doctor? You're going to go with the doctor. I mean, the law requires that nobody else can practice medicine. You go to the person that you believe will take care of your patient, take care of you, take care of your injury. And I think a lot of the problem is that mental language is such a vague term a lot of the times. I personally prefer to gauge it in terms of the statute itself, that if it were intended to be excluded, that we wouldn't have had just the term actual damages. I think nowhere in the DTPA does it say, well, you can't recover from mental anguish. And the law is consistent with that, the law that has been handed down.
Yeah, let me ask a question in that regard. Again, assuming the lawsuit had no value, you say, well, the DTPA was designed to protect you where this type of situation occurs. Then is it your position that like Mr. Gano's argument, what the damages are is the dollar per gallon of gasoline for traveling 30 miles and for making a couple of phone calls, because those phone calls would not have otherwise been made but for their understanding that a lawsuit had been filed?
No, sir, I think it's just an example. That's just an example. If there's a legal loophole in Michigan, and I don't think that there is, because the mental anguish damages were compensable, I don't think there has to be an out-of-pocket an economic expense. I think that the law allows the mental anguish to be recovered absent any out-of-pocket.
Well, the mental anguish measured against a $250,000 claim they should have had, or is the mental anguish measured against driving 30 miles to this office, is my question.
Measured against the claim they should have had, but for Mr. Latham preventing them from going further, looking for others. If he wasn't going to do it, he should have allowed them that opportunity. He excluded them from that opportunity. He omitted telling them. And then when it was brought to his attention, he misrepresented that he had ever represented Kay. He did both. We asked
any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
If I believed it were procedurally proper, I would have been standing up objecting. A lot of what you just heard has nothing to do with what's in the record. There was no medical testimony whatsoever. There is no proof whatsoever of any snipping or contracting meningitis. There are some basic medical records that were proven up as business records, but there was no expert testimony saying what happened to these children in the case below. Furthermore, there was no evidence that there was anything paid out of pocket in the way of gas or telephone calls or anything else.
Under your theory, you could not sue under the DTPA unless you had two types of expert testimony in this case, right? One, medical expert testimony establishing the underlying culpability of the medical practitioner, and number two, legal expert testimony establishing Mr. Latham's deviation from minimum standards of care. Is that correct?
I believe that would be the best way to do it, and I want to make sure that I'm answering this correctly.
I just want to make sure that would be required, is my question.
I believe the very minimum would be proof that the underlying lawsuit was valuable.
Well, wouldn't you still have to prove if in fact the DTPA does not protect anything more than what a negligence suit would protect in terms of legal malpractice action, wouldn't you also have to provide an expert to testify that Mr. Latham's conduct fell beneath the minimum standard of care? Or are you saying that the DTPA leapfrogs that normal evidence requirement in a DTPA case?
I don't know. And the reason that I'm having a problem with that is because this is a missed deadline case, that it seems so much easier to say that if there was value, it was lost. But I think we would have had to have some kind of testimony showing that it was something that could have been filed within the deadline. So I think you're correct that you would have to have expert testimony on both of those aspects of this case, even under the DTCA.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that there is a letter to Mr. Rodriguez that values the case at $250,000?
Let me explain that. What Mr. Latham explained to the court below in his testimony was he was hired to collect on behalf of the Castillos because of that, the settlement of the default. The default judgment was obtained in the name of Sarah only, and what he was doing was he was just, for make-weight purposes, telling the insurance company that there's another child out here, too, that may have a claim. And he was putting a number on that in order to jack up the settlement on the legal malpractice against the first lawyer. It had nothing to do with an opinion as far as a medical malpractice case, because we're still talking about that default judgment for $6 million, and the only question being whether or not it was going to be collectible.
But isn't the value of the legal malpractice case directly related to the value of the underlying medical malpractice case?
No, because the value of the default judgment was $6 million that they just went in and got. And that is the benchmark that they were using. And it had nothing to do with whether or not the underlying lawsuit could have gotten $6 million.
So you're saying that the insurance company paid, Mr. Rodriguez's legal malpractice insurance company paid $400,000 without any proof that the underlying medical malpractice lawsuit was any good?
That's correct, because they were looking at legal malpractice with respect to the $6 million judgment, whether or not it was collectible, and what kind of work was done between the lawyer and his client in arriving at a $70,000 settlement for that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument for the fourth case. The court will now take another decision.
All right.